Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. Lawrence.edu. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or RutabagaShop.com.
Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Time for Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. Good to be with you. Each week, it's my privilege to rub elbows and vocal cords with some of the most interesting and enthusiastic people. Each time you go to a play, a concert, a gallery, a reading, or a festival, think about the people it took to put it on, rallying to provide the rest of us with things to enjoy, places to go, people to see and hear. And those are the folks, and this is the work we spotlight and acknowledge each week here on Spectrum West. Today, we have news about the 7th summer season of Music in the Park in Ladysmith. It starts next week and goes through the end of August. Wisconsin's first public school teacher was a Native American woman, more than a pioneer, and Jim Oliver talks with the author of a book about her. Saturday evening in Stockholm is going to be delicious and delectably entertaining as people gather to feed each other and learn a lot more about the food they eat and how to prepare it from a farmer and a chef. It's called Food for Thought. How does your kitchen garden grow? The Wide Spot is where it all happens on Saturday. And those along and within the St. Croix River Valley have an affinity for their Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. It truly is a super setting for everything artistic and creative and entertaining. Well, it's time to put our donations next to our devotion. The Phipps is in the middle of a campaign to raise the funds necessary to continue as one of the busiest centers for the arts in all of West Wisconsin and also eastern Minnesota as well. It hasn't initiated a capital campaign for many years. This one is called Staging Our Future, and chairman of the campaign is longtime Phipps enthusiast, Mr. Todd Gillingham. Well, I was surprised, Todd, to read that it's been 22 years since the last campaign to raise funds for maintenance and renovation. I then realized, however, that all that time slipped by because all the rooms and the theaters and the galleries are being so consistently used that you just don't recognize the need for renovation until it really needs it. Is that kind of it in a nutshell?
That's it. The fun thing is we're celebrating 30 years as an arts organization serving our patrons in the St. Croix River Valley, certainly Wisconsin, Twin Cities area. And you're right, we are overflowing with the people that love the Phipps, and they're participating in theater, dance, music, comedic drama extravaganzas. It's just a great place to have in the St. Croix River Valley, and we've been very blessed to be able to celebrate 30 years. We've got great leadership with Executive Director John Potter, been with us since nearly the beginning of the Phipps Center for the Arts. Mm-hmm. He and I grew up not far from each other in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and who knew years later we'd be working together ensuring that the Phipps Center for the Arts is around for another 30 years.
Your history as a patron and volunteer is what?
Oh, we certainly enjoy coming to as many shows as possible, whether it's the art galleries or whether it's actually something on the stage. But Chris and I, my wife and I, have three boys, and our introduction to the Phipps was through Sarah Birch and her violin studio and going to many recitals over the years, and what started out as kind of sawing on the violin actually turned into some beautiful music, and proud to say all three boys have gone on. In fact, we've got two graduating from St. Olaf this coming Sunday, but the Phipps and the musical start with Sarah and the violin was very important to their development, and certainly attached Chris and I and our family to the Phipps Center for the Arts.
Congratulations on the graduating students.
Thank you.
You know, an active, vital place like the Phipps is very proud of all the sustaining participation that it receives, in the form of people who contribute time and energy and money. This is one of those rare occasions when capital is the most needed. Let's talk about the needs. Where are the generous donations going to be applied, donations that come in during this campaign?
Yeah, the various councils working in tandem with John Potter, the executive director, and the board of directors has been very specific. I think sometimes organizations have campaign, and people really want to know, what am I supporting? And so specifically, you know, almost to the penny, renovation of the interior, $186,000, renovate and improve the galleries, $117,000, theatrical lighting. We have, unfortunately, older lighting, and to convert to, obviously, a more green environment and using LED, that's pricey at $182,000, but long-term, certainly will save the FIPS money by being more efficient. We've also got a pottery studio that serves our potters and those that want to become potters, but certainly needs an upgrade, and so that's specifically called out. We've got a lovely old Baldwin grand piano, but with the scale of the talent that comes through the FIPS, we need something better, and so we're looking at you know, a considerable amount to look at a Steinway grand. So there are probably 11 to 12 items at least that have been called out as not just wants, but really needs if we want to continue the quality of art in the St. Croix River Valley.
That's the voice of Todd Gillingham. He's chair of the FIPS Center for the Arts fundraising campaign. On now, it's called Staging Our Future. Todd, is there room for expansion, or does the FIPS have to make the best of the space it has?
We're really locked into where we're at alongside the beautiful St. Croix River, Lakefront Park in Hudson, Wisconsin, and you know, very vital downtown, great restaurants, and we think great theater among the other art offerings at the FIPS. But certainly to improve and upgrade the facilities through this fairly modest $1.4 million capital campaign and then another $1 million to support the endowment. That's really our aim as patrons of the FIPS. And if I could, I think the economics sometimes is lost on your listeners in terms of a facility like the FIPS, especially when we're asking for money. But it's been proven on an annual basis, the FIPS is really a cornerstone of a blossoming arts community in the Valley that contributes over $16 million throughout the Valley each year, and we think that number is going to continue to grow and thrive.
Along with needs that we've spelled out, there are amenities that primary centers for the arts, like the FIPS, require to sustain their ability to secure outstanding performances. You mentioned the new grand piano. Are there any other amenities that you have your eyes on that you need? I think that I read something about a harpsichord.
Yeah, a digital harpsichord. We have at our service a great talent, Leighton James, Skip James as we affectionately know him. He's the retired keyboardist for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. He builds harpsichords, and so you can bet when it comes to purchasing a digital harpsichord and that grand piano I referred to before, we're going to ask for the help of Leighton to help us select the best for the FIPS. But there are other items, you know, the seating in the theater, certainly fine, but it's been 30 years, Alan, and
sure.
So it is time to do some renovation there and make things more comfortable for our patrons.
And a lot of the application of the generosity are things that just won't be seen. I mean, it has to do with infrastructure as well, yes?
Yeah, it's quite a structure. Those that have visited the FIPS, and certainly an invitation to those that haven't, get to know us. But it does cost about $3,500 per day just to keep the doors open. And, of course, you're looking at staff, but a lot of that is just maintenance of grounds and boilers and chillers, and it's a significant space. We're very thankful of our longstanding patrons that help us with the annual campaign every year, and a big majority of them and others are stepping up to help with this capital campaign. And already, you know, I can't say thank you enough for the continued support that those individuals and corporations and foundations are providing us at the FIPS.
And the release that I received from the aforementioned Executive Director John Potter had some impressive numbers. I was extremely impressed with the over 750 volunteers contributing over, well, nearly 47,000 hours of support, the equivalent of over 22 full-time staff positions. That's impressive that you can get that many people to care that much about that facility.
Well, John and his staff are great stewards and have been for 30 years. And, of course, things change and people come and go. But John has been a mainstay, part of that culture that he's created with help from his staff and perhaps the board is one of volunteering is good, it's healthy, no matter what age. We have young volunteers, we have those that are getting to be older like myself, and they really are the lifeblood of the Phipps Center for the Arts, and we can't say thank you enough. We just had our Cheers for Volunteers event a few weeks ago. We try to do that annually because without them, you know, we wouldn't be able to open our doors.
Well, the culmination of the kind of conversation we've had is how can people contribute?
We have three different levels. We have a pace setter group for gifts over $25,000. We have major gifts, $5,000 to $25,000. And then our community kickoff just occurred for gifts up to $5,000. We have a great steering committee that have been fully engaged since the board approved this capital campaign a year ago. Mm-hmm. And if people do want to learn more, I would invite them certainly to go to the website, thephipps.org, or contact us via telephone. Ask for John Potter, 715-386-2305. It's interesting. We've got friends certainly in the Valley, and when I mention the Phipps, sometimes people smile and say, sure, we understand where it is, and we have attended, and we love the Phipps, but there's a lot of people in western Wisconsin, throughout the state, and the Twin Cities area that don't have a clue. And so part mm-hmm. of this outreach not only is for gifts, but also expand our audience of people to get to know the Phipps, because it is really a jewel of the St. Croix River Valley. I certainly want to keep it for generations to come.
Hear, hear. Todd Gillingham, thanks for your time, and also thanks for saying yes when being asked to chair the campaign Staging Our Future.
Thank you, Alan.
Once again, to be part of this popular wave of support, the website is thephipps, that's P-H-I-P-P-S, .org. And the phone number is 715-386-2305. This is Spectrum West.
Support for WPR comes from Water Street Deli in Eau Claire, offering fresh hummus, baba ganoush, and pita chips. Available at the deli, the downtown farmers market, and Just Local Food. On Facebook and at waterstreetdeliandgrocery.com.
Oh, that's right. I'm out of spicy hummus. I better get over there today. I'm Al Ross. Good to be with you today on Spectrum West. Next Friday at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee, it's the White Sidewalls at 7:30 p.m. Friday, June 6th, it's Jazz and Wine at the Mabel, music by Take Two Day. Later in June, it's The Gales of November, a dramatic musical about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Another musical is coming mid-July, The Last 5 Years. You can check on it all at the website mabeltainter.org. Next Wednesday, the 28th, Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant opens the 53rd season at the Red Barn Theater near Rice Lake. The show runs through June 7th. The website is redbarntheater-ricelake.com. A few Spectrum memos for you this morning, or this evening if you're listening on Friday, and we'll have more as the program progresses. Mr. Jim Oliver distinguishes our broadcasts most every week with reports about things going on at theaters and in theater companies of West Wisconsin. He also reads much better and more often than I. So when we received notice about a book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, Jim was cordial enough to pick it up, read it, and then converse with the author.
Electa Quinney, Stockbridge Teacher, is a young reader's book published earlier this year by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. The author is Karen Seaman, who joins us by telephone from her home in Deerfield. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin by telling us about Electa Quinney.
Electa Quinney was born in 1807 in central New York. She was born to, one historian said, the most prominent Stockbridge family in Stockbridge Indian history. Her father and her grandfather and ultimately her brothers were all tribal chiefs. And this opened doors for her. She went to boarding schools in New York, at schools that educated some of the wealthiest white young girls in New York. So she had a very excellent education, went on to work for 6 years as a teacher in New York. And when the Stockbridge Indians relocated to Wisconsin in the 1820s, she came to Wisconsin with them. She arrived in Wisconsin in June 20th, 1828. The school that she first taught at was along the Fox River. It's in what today is Kalkana. And what is really important about that very first school that she taught in is that it was a public school. And if you understand what Wisconsin was like in 1828, Wisconsin didn't even become a territory until 1836. Wisconsin was wilderness. There were some Indians here. There were a few lead miners down in southwest Wisconsin. There were some military forts, but not very many white people in Wisconsin. There were some fur traders up in Green Bay. They tended to either have tutors educating their children at home. Some of the fur traders who could afford it were sending their children up to Canada to school to be educated. But all of the schools, as far as we can tell before this, were all essentially private schools. If you wanted your children to be educated, you had to pay a teacher, or the church had to pay a teacher. But the Stockbridge Indians came to Wisconsin and said, every child who lives in this village, Indian children and also the white children of the white missionaries, needs to go to school. An elective was paid by the public funds of the Indians, which means the Indian tribe paid her salary. This is also important because if you look at the national public school movement, there are people like Horace Mann, who was an educator in Massachusetts. He was the superintendent of schools, I believe, in Massachusetts. And he is often credited with being the father of public education. But Horace Mann didn't really begin to, on a national level, push his idea of public education until the late 1830s. So you have an Indian tribe in the woods of Wisconsin in 1828 doing something way ahead of their time, way ahead of the national movement. And you have a young Indian woman, a young educated Indian woman, teaching at this school. And if you put all of that together, you realize how extraordinary it was that she came here and did that.
So what got you interested in writing about her?
I became interested in the Badger Biography series when I was still writing for the Capital Times newspaper in Madison, and had written a story for the newspaper, a feature story, about the series of books, which were created to supplement the education of fourth graders in Wisconsin public schools. Fourth graders learn about state history, and the Historical Society Press decided that we needed a good series of biographies about interesting Wisconsin people. So they created this series. I did the story for the paper, and then a couple of years later approached the editor there and asked her if I could write one of these books. It interested me. And she said, we'd like you to consider writing about a minority and also about a woman, and maybe a Native American. That would be interesting. And my mother-in-law, her whole family belongs to the Oneida Nation in Green Bay. I began there. I thought that would be interesting for my children, who are ages 5 and 10. So I initially said, I'll write something that is about their heritage. And Electa's name kept coming up. Her husband was a Methodist missionary who served the Oneida Indians. And so I said, how about Electa Quinney? And they said, oh, yes, that's excellent choice.
Now, the book is listed for young readers. Now, I gather probably directed more toward fourth graders, although, quite frankly, I've passed the threshold of being a young reader a long, long time ago, but I found the book very interesting. So do you have a specific age level other than just simply fourth grade?
Specifically, they are targeted for a fourth grade reading level. But the different books in the series and the Badger Biography series probably has about 24 books now. They range from a fourth grade to a fifth grade reading level. But I find, and I think others have commented to me, that sometimes it's interesting for adults to read history books, especially at a reading level like this, because the language is so simple. You can find out about a historical topic that you didn't know about before. It's easy to get through.
She is Karen Seaman, who is author of Electa Quinney, Stockbridge Teacher. Authors have told me in the past, that's difficult to find a lot of information when they're trying to do historical books about any women from the 19th century. And similarly, they have trouble finding information about American Indian women. You indicated a similar problem in finding information about Electa Quinney. So tell us how you went about gathering information about her.
I did. When I started this project 4 years ago, I started with a few paragraphs about her. That's the hard thing, definitely, with women of this era. Even educated, intelligent women like Electa. We have very eloquent speeches from her brother. We have legal documents that were prepared by her son, who was an attorney for the Stockbridge Indian tribe. We have examples of things that were printed by her second husband. Her second husband was a newspaper printer. We have bibliographies listing what he did. We have nothing from Electa except for one very short letter she wrote for someone else in 1839. We don't have a diary. We don't have reflections of anything that was going on in her life. So it really became a piecing together. It took me, as I said, 4 years. It took a lot of genealogy work. Her movements from Wisconsin down to Indian Territory, where she lived for about 20 years, which today is the state of Oklahoma. I went from New York to Massachusetts. I spoke with historical societies in Clinton, New York, about the school that she went to, which is still standing today, the boarding school. A lot of work at the Wisconsin Historical Society Archives in Madison. Letters her son saved, but unfortunately, we have letters to her, but not letters that she wrote in response. Women in that age, that era, just did not write down their thoughts and reflections. What you have, though, which is telling, is in the years when she lived in Indian Territory, you have traveling missionaries who would come through. And she lived really in the middle of nowhere, but they knew how to find her, and they would stop at her house. And you have over and over again the diaries of traveling missionaries, and they would write how impressed they were with her and how they walked into her little house and it was full of books. Her children were dressed like white children and spoke English. They would have long conversations with her about very complex topics, Indian treaties, white prejudice, and topics that they didn't expect in that era for a woman to have knowledge of. And that happens over and over again. So obviously, she impressed people.
Well, Electa Quinney was a respected teacher who taught both Indian and white children. So how has education specific to American Indians evolved since her day, especially as it relates to American Indian heritage and culture?
Certainly things changed. Beginning in the 1870s, the boarding school era began. American Indians are still recovering, really, from that era. There were still Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools open around the country. There were actually 11 of them in Wisconsin. The last ones closed in the 1950s. At their peak, early in the 20th century, it was mandatory for Indian children to go to boarding schools, and they took them away as young as age 5 and cut their hair and forbid them to speak their native language. It's a very difficult era for American Indian children, but that was after Electa. That was years later. That was several generations later. And now, when you talk to Indian tribes here in Wisconsin, they're beginning now on a different path. They're teaching their children the native languages. They're learning those languages in school, how to speak them, how to read them, and they're learning about their culture in school again. And the Indian tribes are in control of that learning again.
How about their religious beliefs as well as their cultural heritage? Is there any teaching of the old Indian religions as opposed to what the missionaries taught them back when they first started traveling in this part of the world?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We were just up on the Oneida Reservation a few months ago and took my son, who is 10, and had a wonderful discussion there at the museum and had a little private tour. And they're again, teaching them their native religion, all the creation stories. It's all coming back now. It's taken more than 100 years to bring all that back and be proud of it and to teach it to children so that they understand their culture and their heritage. But there was a long time where that wasn't happening. So we're on an upswing, yes, definitely.
So where is the book available?
Of course, on all the major online sites, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can buy it from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press website. You can buy it at local bookstores. If you have a local bookstore in your community, just call. This is, as I said, a large popular series, Badger Biography series. So schools and bookstores have carried it now for about 5 or 6 years. So definitely available at stores around the state.
The book is Electa Quinney, Stockbridge Teacher. It's written by Karen Seaman. Karen, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Jim Oliver, although he's a weekly fixture, he often feels like a special guest because his donation of time and effort is just that, special. Spectrum Memo Nature Classes are coming to UW Barron County. Plants and Paddling on Saturday, May 31st. Tales from the Medicine Trail meets Sunday, June 1st. Three Ways of Seeing, Biology, Creative Writing, and Visual Art, 4 sessions beginning May 31st. Also, Introduction to Abstract Painting. You can register and pay online at Barron, that's B-A-R-R-O-N, .uwc.edu and click on Community Outreach. May at the Artsy Gallery in Amory features painters Patricia Duncan and Bonnie Hagen and potter Roger Evans. The exhibition is up through May 31st. Their website is artzgallery.org. Currently in the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, you'll see sculptures by Brian Perrell and Christy Skubin. The exhibit is up through June 13th. That website is eauclairearts.com. Well, Saturday evening, there's a wonderful collision going to happen, one that involves the farm and growing good things. Jennifer Lindahl at the wheel there, and the food that those good things are and become. Judy Crone is the cook who will share some of what she knows and has done. And there's you, or us, the people who want to know the answer to the question, how does your kitchen garden grow? Or maybe, how can your kitchen garden grow? And I haven't even mentioned the fact that the entire evening is that marvelous social concept known as potluck. It's a lot of food for thought, and it's a lot three people can talk about. So Judy and Jennifer and I, well, we started down that road. Jennifer, in this day and age, an age of status and achievement and glitz and technological brilliance, you are called a farmer, and I say well done. You could demand that you be called an agrarian or an agronomist, but you're a farmer. That takes some pride. Tell me about what kind of farmer you are.
We have a sustainable farm, mm-hmm. is what we call it. Our goal is not to manage the animals, but to manage the land. So we rotationally graze. We don't feed grain. Mm-hmm. We have cows and goats and sheep. They're moved every day to new pasture. We also raise geese. The geese, they forage, so they don't get grain, but the chickens do. Mm-hmm. And we do meat birds, chickens, and they are moved 2-3 times a day to new grass. They're in a movable pen. And then we raise pigs as well.
Ah. I'd get nervous if I was a bird and I was labeled a meat bird.
Yeah. I don't know that they know that.
So you never call them that when they're next to you?
No, we don't. We talk quietly behind their backs.
Do the kids know that they're meat birds?
They do. We have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, mm-hmm. and we also butcher on the farm. The animals are born on the farm, and they die on the farm. That's very important to us.
Sure.
She has always been around when we've done the processing, and my 3-year-old, when he was not quite 2, he was. We had goat for Thanksgiving, and we did the slaughtering, and he cried. And you know, we sat him down, we explained it to him, and I mm-hmm. said, you know, if you don't want to eat meat, that's okay. And so then he said he didn't want to eat meat, but that just lasted for I think maybe 2 days, and
sure.
he's back to it.
Well, you've been involved in some farmers markets, including the one in Stockholm. Funny how many people believe that farmers markets are this cool, innovative, American networking, face-to-face blog type thing, when in truth, farmers markets have been held worldwide for generations. What has the farmers market trend done for the agricultural arts?
You know, I think I say that it's put a face on your food. I mean, I think that being able to communicate to the person who raises your food is important. I hope that it's educated people so that they go to the grocery store and they start questioning some of the things that they're buying, whether it's produce or processed food, mm-hmm. And knowing where it comes from. And I think that, you know, I think it's also changed the idea of organic, that it not necessarily does it have to be certified organic, but that there is, you know, everybody's way of growing things is done differently. So I just hope that it's made a connection for people. Sure, and it's also about availability. You know, mm-hmm. you can't always get a tomato in June or, you know, obviously in the winter.
Sure.
And I hope that that's what it's done.
Yeah. I wrote a poem once about winter, and it's called Pale Tomatoes.
They are pale, and cardboard. They taste like cardboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. They don't have much taste at all. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, a curiosity of mine, you know, you were talking about how you treat and feed your animals. Mm-hmm. You obviously, somewhere along the line, have been exposed to animals on other farms. Can one tell the difference in demeanor between an animal that's being treated the way you treat them and the other ones who are just sort of part of an assembly line?
Sure, you know, as far as
do they seem happier? Like, I mean, are
yeah, I mean, you know, healthier. I actually was just out in the pasture yesterday taking pictures. We have some new cows mm-hmm. That we got, and I was taking pictures comparing the coat of our new cows to the cows that we have on the farm that have been rotationally grazed, and our cow. We have three cows. So the cow that has been rotationally grazed and no grain, her coat is beautiful and shiny. She comes right up to us. The other cows, you know, they're not used to us, I can't say, but their coats are just, they're just not as beautiful. You know, I think that there's definitely a taste difference, but I don't know about personality. I mean, I think mine are happier. Mine are healthier. I can certainly say that.
You didn't haul the camera out and they smiled? Or
you know, the goats do.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the goats do.
That's good to know.
Yes.
Well, Judy, as a chef for many years, you were on another receiving end of the food chain, as it were, although I read that you, too, grow your own produce and have for years. It's true that many of the most notable chefs in the world, because they realize what it can mean to their craft, have become their own suppliers or have developed and maintained some close relationships with farmers. Put into words, if you can, the difference fresh stuff, trusted stuff can make.
Well, I'm happy to say I'm putting in my 40th vegetable garden this year in Wisconsin. So I do like to be able to grow and harvest my own food and to preserve it and keep it going to sustain us throughout the winter months when we don't have fresh fruit and vegetables available. I think from the perspective of a chef, you like to know where your food is coming from. You like to feel as though you're serving the best quality produce or meat or eggs or dairy products to your customers, the people that you're feeding. And I think you like to know where things are coming from, and you, I think, like to understand maybe why the things are fresher if you get them closer to home. And also if process used to raise and grow those things is done in a sensible way to protect the farm workers, and there's a whole lot of other economic issues that are addressed, more and more people are becoming aware of. Mm-hmm. And I think people, again, like Jennifer says, it's putting a face on the food. We don't necessarily put a face on the food, but in the restaurant business, everybody's putting a name of the grower next to the product. So it's a growing trend in the restaurant business.
I'm one of those guys that when I'm in the produce department at the grocery store, I literally pick the stuff up and feel it as if I know what I'm doing. Once I saw an article or read an article about how to determine when a cantaloupe is right, you know,
right.
To buy. And I don't know. I mean, sometimes it comes home right, sometimes it doesn't. You must be a master at that kind of stuff, picking up food.
I wouldn't call myself a master. I do spend a lot of time with my face over the pile of cantaloupes and you know, you're thumping and, you know, looking for the smell of fruit. Excuse me, I'm in the city and there's a lot of fire trucks or something going by right now. I hope that's not.
Actually, recording. You know what's cool about that is you have all this metropolitan sound going on in your background, and Jennifer has animals going on in the background there. What a cool.
Yeah, and I'm not really an urban person, but here I am in an urban setting right now for this conversation. But we just had a conversation over breakfast about how to choose a melon, and you know sometimes you get lucky and and sometimes you don't.
Most people, Judy, that I know, realize that growing and harvesting and preparing and preserving are all great ways to live and eat, but it does take a commitment and it does take some work. The restaurant trade wouldn't be doing as well as it is if more and more Americans believe that enough to actually do it. So they need a nudge, and Saturday coming up at the Wide Spot is that kind of a nudge, isn't it? It feels that way to me.
That is correct. Where Jennifer and I are doing a presentation at the Wide Spot to just talk about growing foods, or if not growing it, finding it close to home, and some ideas for cooking it. I'd like to think that television 24-hour-a-day cooking programs, even though I like to watch them when I can, have done kind of a disservice to make people kind of afraid about cooking, or the reality shows, the Top Chef, the Iron Chef, makes people afraid to cook. And everybody, not everybody, but lots of people have a gourmet kitchen, and they eat out all every meal of the day. So I like to try to demystify cooking. I do some classes at the Palette Gourmet Kitchen Store in Stockholm and at a community ed program down in Pepin, trying to teach people that cooking is pretty simple and it's pretty basic, and you don't need to have a lot of fancy equipment or skills to put together a good meal, but what you do need is good ingredients.
That's the voice of Judy Crone, who along with Jennifer Lindahl is on the phone with us. We're talking about the program, How Does Your Kitchen Garden Grow? It's coming up at the Wide Spot in Stockholm Saturday, beginning at 6 p.m., and it does include potluck.
Absolutely. We make the greatest potlucks around here.
Food for thought. It's called Potluck and Presentation. Tell me about the potluck part, because I don't think you're looking for anything fancy from attendees. Are you, Jennifer?
Oh, no, no. And I have to say, being new to the Stockholm area, Stockholm residents really know how to do up a potluck.
They do.
I've been to several of them, and there is a wide variety, and there are some really amazing cooks that live in our area.
I mean, is it just a bunch of casseroles?
There are casseroles. I've had, there's fresh fruit and fresh vegetables, and there's some pies and cakes. The last one that I was at, somebody made candies, these little chocolate truffles.
Hmm.
They were amazing. It's the best buffet I've ever been to.
You got me drooling here. I think I might.
And this the idea of behind the How Does Your Kitchen Garden Grow is that it's actually going to be the Saturday prior to the start of the farmers market in Stockholm.
Ah.
So our farmers market is Fridays, starting June 6th. And so the idea is to get people thinking about where either are they going to grow their own kitchen garden, or is it going to be supplied by their garden in their backyard, or by a local CSA, or by the farmer's market.
Sure.
The roadside stand, or the pick-your-own blueberry, strawberry fruit place in the area.
Those are, I dare to say, more popular today than they were 20 years ago.
For me, I don't know. I've always gone strawberry picking. I remember going with my mom, and I actually went when I was in college. I was the only college student, I think, out there, but I loved fresh.
Well, you guys are very good at what you do, but, you know, in conclusion, I think, and I'd like a comment from each of you on it, but I think we can make a difference by teaching our kids these arts. I know that Jennifer is doing that. And by doing that, we could turn around a trend that kind of started to change the moment our grandma's aprons started collecting dust.
I think you're right, Al. This is Judy talking. I do think that more and more kids are losing touch. They think a potato is a French fry.
Mm-hmm.
They think a chicken comes in a package and from the store, or strawberry is the thing that's inside a piece of pastry that they put in their toaster in the morning. One of the things that I've done for the last 3 years is a cooking class, an after-school cooking class, with junior high students at Pepin School. This year we made our own fresh pasta and we made sauce from scratch. So just teaching them some basic cooking skills and how to make some healthy snacks for themselves that don't involve a lot of expensive ingredients or tricky techniques or anything like that, and get them more in touch. And I know Pepin has a school garden, and they do 3 or 4 events a year. So they are teaching kids that food can be made. You don't have to just go buy it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that kids have lost touch, but I think it's not just the kids, it's the parents. And, you know, taking your kids to the farmer's market or to a local garden center or a pick-your-own place is important. I think, you know, not just getting people in the kitchen, getting them outside and, you know, how does a tomato grow? You know, does it come off of a tree or out of the ground? I mean, I think that kids are just, they're fed. I mean, they go to school, they get fed. They come home, they get fed. There's no connection to where that food comes from. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the goal of our farm. Our farm is an educational farm where we teach people how to live sustainably, and whether that's providing their own garden or, you know, just foraging. There's having a couple apple trees, making your own tomato sauce, whatever that is, our goal is to help connect people to the land and to the food. I hope that this is not something that gets lost.
It all sounds so wonderful, but the main thing is that we have to get up off our best intentions and literally do it. If we're adults, it can make our life more interesting and more delicious. If we're adults with kids, we can impart some of that information to them. Chef Judy Crone, farmer Jennifer Lindahl, How Does Your Kitchen Garden Grow? Saturday at the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm. Thank you, ladies, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
The Wide Spot, by the way, is on Spring Street in Stockholm. Remember, it sounds to me like they put the luck in potluck. What a great word that is. Kind of strange if you dissect it, but it's been a part of our lives for so long. It's just an instant impression of people getting together. Of course, potluck could also mean I moved to Colorado. Might have to think about that for just a minute. Last weekend, we lost another of the premier male voices of the past 60 years. The end of an era is quickly drawing closer. So for a moment on Spectrum West, let's hang on and remember Jerry Vale.
The very thought of you and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king, and foolish though it may seem to me, that's everything, the mere idea of you. The longing here for you, you'll never know how slow the moments go till I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower, your eyes and stars above. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
Wow, closing my eyes, I can imagine the album turning on my parents' hi-fi. Jerry Vale. Spectrum Memo, remember, this is the culmination of Fresh Paint 2014, the plein air event in Durand. Today, Thursday, they're painting, and there'll be a nocturne demo. Friday is painting, framing, the exhibition, and awards ceremony, and Saturday, more exhibition, and the sale at the Old Courthouse Museum on Washington Square. Well, I can hear it off in the distance, all the way from Ladysmith, the sound of musicians tuning up and people for miles around buzzing about this summer's Season 7 of Music in the Park. Arlene Knops and Georgie Anderson, two of the many who make it happen, huddled around a speakerphone just the other day. Georgie, how does the 7th annual Music in the Park series differ from the first? More extravagant? Is it longer? Is it what?
Not any longer, but it's we have different musicians every year, some of the same ones. Got good ones this year.
She books all the bands or the musical entertainment for the Music in the Park.
So what's that process like? Is that just a lot of phone calls and emails, or do you have people coming out of the woodwork saying, I want to play in this, or how does that go?
A little bit of everything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. Mostly I do the phone calls. Some people, they call and see what's up, but mostly I call them because we know a lot of musicians, so I just call them and ask if they'd like to do it.
Okay, and most of them would, I'll bet.
Why, I guess so.
I mean, this is a big gig for them.
True, true. A lot of exposure.
Were either of you around when people got together to hatch the idea of Music in the Park?
I was not. I was. It's sponsored by the Rusk Area Arts Alliance, mm-hmm. which is a group of everything from painters to potters to weavers to singers to dancers, everything. And our role is to try to promote art in the community, and that's kind of where it started from at one of our meetings, talking about what can we do to put something out that the community would enjoy.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, I'm trying to picture the meeting where everybody's there, because, you know, that's kind of a big undertaking to have Music in the Park series, because there's a lot of work that goes into just getting it going and then obviously keeping it going.
Definitely, and I know that, you know, there's been different people that have run it over the years. Now, Georgie has done it the last 4 years, so we hang on to her because she's doing a good job.
How many people does it take? I mean, what kinds of volunteers are there on any given evening?
Well, really, it's Georgie and her husband, Don, Nancy, who is the head of the Arts Alliance, and another gentleman named Billy, who, you know, helps with the setup. And, you know, it's pretty informal. It's at Memorial Park, which is right on the Flambeau River, so it's a beautiful setting. People bring their own chairs. There's a covered area where the band sets up, but otherwise people just come. There's no charge. They mm-hmm. just come and put down their chairs and enjoy the music.
I mean, you have 14 different dates, I noted,
mm-hmm.
two of which are at Ladysmith High School. One's a jazz band and one is the community band. And what, maybe they're a little too big for the other place, or they don't want to be outside in case?
Well, they've got a lot of equipment, and it's really hard to transport that equipment and set it up for a couple hours.
Uh-huh.
It's just easier for them to work at the high school.
So a typical Thursday evening at Memorial Park in Ladysmith, you've already told me that people bring their chairs and they sit and watch. Can they bring stuff? Can they bring stuff to eat? Can they bring stuff to...
Certainly, sure. They can even have a picnic if they want to.
Okay. How about, is there room to dance?
Well, you'd have to dance on the grass or the blacktop, but it can be done.
Ah.
In fact, when one of the guys is playing, maybe we'll have a dance contest.
I think you should.
I think so, too.
That's a good idea. See, you know, this is a brainstorm session in itself.
There you go.
Now, if one goes to the website, which is RuskCountyWI.com or FlambeauValley.com, one finds a lot of activity. I mean, there are flea markets, classic auto shows, rallies, fairs, bluegrass festivals, auctions, farmers markets, and several groups involved. Talk about the art of coordinating everything. I mean, do you guys all get together to meet and synchronize dates? How does that work?
Well, you know, being it's a small community, many weekends there's 3-4 events going on at the same time. You kind of just have to pick and choose where you want to go. Many of them, the larger events like the community fairs, are all on a set weekend, and we know that each year, you know, like my Bluegrass Festival is the second weekend in June.
Sure.
So other organizations know these things or call me and say, when's this or that, so I don't double up.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, that's the luxury of being in a small town.
Yes.
On the phone with us, Arlene Knops and Georgie Anderson, and we are talking about the 7th Music in the Park series in Ladysmith. Lots goes on in Ladysmith in the summer, and we'll be giving you updates on some of that as the summer progresses. If one of you would like, or maybe one of you take 7, the other take the other 7, give us the lineup. I don't have a lot of time, but you could name who's coming on each particular date. How's that?
Okay, Wednesday the 28th. Is the Ladysmith High School Jazz Band at Ladysmith High School. June 5th is Joe's Music Kids. These are all young students taking music lessons.
Okay.
June 12th, the Country Ramblers. June 19th, Two for the Road. And June 26th, the Altoona Cowboy.
July 3rd is Danville, which is sponsored by Flambeau Valley Arts Association. July 10th is John Fox, Deja Vu 2.0. And July 17th is the Mardi Gras, so there's no music in the park. July 24th is John Matuszynski and the Bluegrass Express. July 31st is the Nudo Dixie Band. August 7th is Johnny Neal and Second Chance. August 14th is the community band at Ladysmith High School Auditorium. August 21st is George Dooms, known as Mr. Concertina. And August 28th is Ladysmith City Limits Show.
That's quite a lineup. Is there a lot of new stuff this summer?
Yeah, the Country Ramblers are new. Steve Zeidel is new.
Mm-hmm.
The Nudo Dixie Band is new. Johnny Neal and Second Chance is new. George Dooms is new. And the rest are all standbys that we call every year.
I might drive up just to see the Nudo Dixie Band just because they have a cool name.
And they are very, very good.
Really? Where are they from?
Rice Lake, Cumberland, Birchwood area, and most of them are in their 80s.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Well, all right.
Fantastic.
Cool. Well, nice work, ladies. Way to go on putting together another season, the seventh in the Music in the Park series in Ladysmith. Thank you for bringing us up to speed. And as I said earlier, we will keep in touch, and I hope you do, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Arlene and Georgie. There was a song and a movie about her back in 1966, I think, wasn't there? Our reporter's checking in from Ladysmith for Things Heat Up beginning next Wednesday and then every Thursday evening after that, except for the week Mardi Gras, you know. Let's see, Spectrum Memo, the Festival Theater offers Drumming 101 with Don Karski Saturday, 10 a.m. in the Elbow Room. He plays all sorts of drums, and you can participate in a drum circle, too. The Wisconsin Canoe Heritage Museum in Spooner celebrates its fourth summer season opening event Saturday. It's Wisconsin Canoe Heritage Day from 11 to 4. Canoe builders, live music, museum tours, food and beverages, and the beer garden. There's the key couple of words there, beer garden. It's on North Front Street in Spooner. Friday, the Citizen Science Center at Beaver Creek Reserve hosts the first Big Bird Day fundraiser. So much going on in West Wisconsin all the time, especially heading into summer. Next week on Spectrum West, our 250th program, by the way. He teaches Scandinavian studies. He has his hands on more history and music and stories than anyone I've met before. Jim Leary is here. Brent Hensel is from Black River Falls, got a history degree from UW-Eau Claire. Now he's the curator of the Green Bay Packer Hall of Fame. He's going to join us. We'll get to know the Sierra Club a bit better and about some of the ways they raise what they need to do the good work they do, and more. Always more on Spectrum West. Thanks, and remember, we come back at you at 7 p.m. each Friday over on the News and Classical Music Network stations of Western Wisconsin. See you.